So last week, I said a bunch of stuff about why Christianity is fundamental, foundational, transformational. I spent some time with Alvin Schmidt's book, How Christianity Changed the World. And there were a couple of people afterwards who were like, okay, come on, that's a little over the top. Well, first of all, your beef is with Schmidt, not with me. But here's the, you know, Christians really did invent the hospital. There are a lot of hospitals today that are run by people that are not Christians, but the concept, the idea, the motive behind it is a product of Christians in the church. And that is true with very, very many things that are true about our life and the world today, is that these things are the product of Christians who are following God and who did things which have become the standard. Christians invented the university for theological purposes. Most of the most famous universities in America were founded, Harvard and Yale were founded as divinity schools. They were founded, in the case of Harvard, by Puritans who wanted a school that would produce Puritan preachers to carry the gospel forward. That's not what Harvard does anymore. But that's why Harvard was founded. And it's one of the things that is fascinating to me about many of the great institutions of our nation and the era, is that they are doing something today that is entirely different than what they were founded to do. And when you're running an institution that is doing something that is entirely at odds with the thing it was founded to do, that puts you in kind of an interesting place. You know, when you are abandoning or to some extent rejecting your own history. But Christians are at the foundation of so many things that are part of our world today. And that's one of the reasons why we want to spend some time looking at and thinking about the history of the church and the history of Christians over the last two millennia as Christians have engaged the culture and have sought to build the kingdom of God for the sake of his glory. So next slide, please. So last week, we started with the idea that our history is foundational to us, and just a reminder that the things that are chronicled in the Gospels and Acts, the things of the New Testament, are true. They really happened to real people. There's been quite a number of people down through the ages who have set out to disprove the Gospels. And particularly, people that understand anything about Christianity realize that the thing that they need to disprove is the resurrection. And there's a cool book by a lawyer called Who Moved the Stone? By a guy who started out with the objective of proving that the resurrection was a fraud. And so he approached this from a kind of a legal perspective with a legal mind. And, of course, along the way, he was converted to the faith and wrote a book about why the resurrection really happened. A guy named Josh McDowell became famous because he sat down to accumulate all the information that would allow him to conclusively disprove Christianity, and ended up publishing a book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict, which is a compilation of all of his notes about why Christianity is true, which he turned into a best-selling paperback called More Than a Carpenter, which is one of the bestsellers of the 1970s. Josh McDowell is still around, he's an apologist for the faith. But he became an apologist for the faith because he attempted to disprove it. So... And, these are just a couple of stories. There's been multiple stories down through the years. Christianity is historical truth. The people that have seriously looked at it have all concluded that these events actually happen, that these things really are true. So Christianity is not a system of ethics or a philosophical assertion. Okay. I talked a little bit about Zoroastrianism last week, and Zoroaster, who founded Zoroastrianism 26 centuries ago, asserted some philosophical things. There's not actually any proof that any of those things are true, but Zoroastrianism is based on the things that Zoroaster said. Buddhism is based on things that Buddha said. But there's not any actual, you know, Buddha is a person. We know very little about what happened. Zoroaster is a person. We know very little about his life. But these people asserted philosophical ideas. Christianity isn't like that. Christianity isn't a philosophical idea. Jesus Christ lived and was crucified and was resurrected. That's the core of our faith. If that's not true, the rest of it doesn't matter. The rest of it is of no significance whatsoever if those are not historical events. And that's different. This is different from any other religion on the face of the earth ever. So, and Jesus is, you know, as a historical figure, is unlike anybody else. There's nobody else. There's nobody else who makes the claims that Jesus does all through history. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the light. No one comes to the Father but by me. Okay, when guys like Thomas Jefferson start editing the Bible to make it more comfortable for them, that's where they start, is putting, taking the Sharpie and lining out that kind of stuff, because they're like, that makes me so uncomfortable, it must not be true. Okay? Because if that statement is true, it demands that you do something. It demands that you respond to it. So, but our history helps us to understand, you know, how do we get here and who we are. So, so our history also helps us to steer, that is, to understand how do we go forward in the world? How do we go forward in this life? How do we persist in that which is true? How do we stick on the track? How do we stay on the right path? We need markers. Your word is a lamp unto my feet. So we need not to lose track of who we are, where, you know, why do we do what we do. So when we make decisions, we've got to persist in the truth. You know, one of the challenges that we have in the church always is to remember, who we are and why we exist. You know, people from time to time have asked me, you know, what do you do? What do you do as the chairman of the board? I mean, I run some meetings and stuff, but my job is to remind us who we are and why we exist, to help us steer, to persist in the truth. You know, we're not a social service agency, we're a church. We're about the gospel. We're about the gospel in this place. We're a church in this community. That means that we're going to do different things. You know, Barrett and I were talking a little bit before about in the 60s, there was no Christian bookstore in the state of Rhode Island. And so we built an addition on a building across the street and had a Christian bookstore. And when I became the chairman of the board back in 2007, we still had a Christian bookstore, except it was no longer the only Christian bookstore. So 13 years after the bookstore closed, we had somebody come by recently looking for our bookstore because they assumed it must still be here. Because, you know, we must still be doing that. Because in the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s, the Christian bookstore in the state of Rhode Island was here. By 2007, you know, there was a Morningstar up on Bald Hill. Christian Book Distributors was available online. Amazon was selling Christian books. P&R Publishing has their, you know, website. You can buy direct from them. So, you know, people were coming to our bookstore by 2007 mostly to buy greeting cards. Well, okay, is that core to the mission of the gospel in this place? So we gave up the bookstore. And there were some people who were heartbroken over that because they were like, no, you gotta keep the bookstore. No, we gotta keep focused on what is the mission of the gospel in this place today. We did the bookstore to fill a need, but the need had gone away. Because the need had gone away, we need to do something else. So we had a lot of parking lot. We put some basketball hoops out there. And we had, Dick Donnelly was doing a clothing ministry out of the trunk of his car. And so we decided to take that and turn it into functionally retail for the sake of the gospel. How long will we have a clothing closet? As long as it resonates in this community as a way for the gospel to go forward. As long as we can use that to help us persist in carrying this truth. That's the point. It's a means. The bookstore is a means. Clothing closet is a means. The basketball courts are a means. You know, there are people that call us Squid Nested Basketball Church, but we will not do basketball forever. Because at some point, it will no longer be a useful means to engage this community, at which point we will stop and we need to do something else. Because our job is to persist in the work of the gospel, persist in the truth. So this means that when you think about bringing change to the church, and almost everybody has some idea about what the change should be, and they're not all about music, but you know, if you're thinking about bringing change to the church, you should never be thinking about bringing change unless you understand fundamentally why we exist and what we do. Because if you don't understand why we exist and what we do, you shouldn't be messing with it. You're not in any position to mess with it. So in my day job, this is one of the things I teach, is, you know, if you're trying to bring change to your organization, you better understand why it's the way it is to begin with. Because otherwise, you're playing with fire, because you don't know. And the places where churches have really gone off track, and we as a church in general have gone off track, have been when we forgot the focus on the truth, and we got carried away doing other things. So, and so we study history partly because we don't want to make the same mistakes. We want to make all new and different mistakes, right? So, but you know, if you were good at learning from your experience, I ask people in my day job this, you know, if you were really good at learning from your experience, what would be true? You wouldn't make the same mistakes twice, right? And how many of you, by that standard, are really good at learning from your experience? Because you never make the same mistakes twice, right? You don't go down the same roads. You know, you find ways to make all new mistakes, but you don't make the same mistakes. No, as human beings, we fall into the same kinds of things, and we make the same mistakes over and over again. We don't learn from our experience very well. But the more that we focus on history and spend some time studying history, the less likely we are to at least make the mistakes of other people that have come before us. So there's value. The heresies that we face in the current era are mostly heresies that were in existence in the first century. They look different, but they're basically the same arguments. They're basically the same foolishness, the same wrong. So we fall prey to the same sins as people from centuries before us. If we understand something about what happened to them and what they struggled with, we are likely to be more effective at dealing with the things today. Because the same questions, the same concerns recur across the generations. So, you know, and history is therefore a guide. It assists us in correcting evil, avoiding error, because we can look back and say, what have others said and done about these same things? So, and, you know, when you're steering a ship, if you're looking at the wake all the time, you're going to crash. You can't steer by looking backwards. But if you never look backwards, you don't know where you've been, and you don't understand. You know, Jim and I share some background in the Navy, of course. You know, one of the things I learned piloting a ship, standing on the bridge of a ship, you know, I was a helicopter pilot, so this was a side gig for me, but I did it a little bit. And one of the things I learned was that you got to go out on the bridge wing and look aft from time to time, because the wake gives you information about how you're doing. And if the wake is zigzaggy, something is not right. And if the wake has a big curve in it, there's something going on. If you think you're steering straight and the wake isn't a straight line, you're not steering straight. There is something going on. Now, that might be the current is running, you know, 5 knots across your track and pushing you sideways. And if you're going into port, that's a big deal, by the way. Entering the harbor at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, the harbor entrance is long, flat beach, and then there's an entrance to the harbor, and there's two buoys. And there's a lot of ships that have gotten into trouble because they get between the two buoys, and they're aimed at the harbor entrance, and they think, I'm good to go. Well, it's a beach. There's a current that runs along the beach. Sometimes it runs right to left, and sometimes it runs left to right. And if you're not paying attention to the current, you're going to end up on the beach, even if the bow is pointed at the harbor entrance. If you're going sideways, you're not going to get there. If you're not looking aft, you're not going to know whether you're going sideways. So we check the wake to help us steer. And we think about history also because we need to be reminded. We need to be reminded about a lot of stuff. And it's one of the functions that we have in the church, and we do annual meeting every year, and I try to use it as a reminder. You know, where have we come from? What has happened? Because stuff vanishes from our mind so quickly. You remember that thing that you were praying so intently about? You know, less than a year ago, that thing that was overwhelming your life, that thing that you were so focused on, you were laying awake at night, you were praying about it, you were so concerned about it. Remember that thing? And God did something and it got better. And now, how often do you think about that? It tends to vanish, right? If we don't look back, if we don't remember, we forget. We forget what He did. We forget how He has worked in our lives. We forget the things that we prayed for that God brought to pass. And so we need, you know, to be thankful for all the things that God has done. And we are thankful because we remember. And one of the things that's going on in the dynamic of life is that the world is throwing lots of stuff at you so you won't spend time remembering and being thankful. So that you'll be consumed by the moment and you will forget to be thankful. So, you know, we need some respect for our heritage. Those who came before us have served faithfully and well. We inherit a church that is a product of the faithfulness of many people down over long years. The gospel has been preserved because God has used many faithful people down through the years. And we need to appreciate that. And also, we need to be inspired by that we are the faithful today. And we carry that same load today. But we are never, you know, in the church, we are never in year zero. You know, a totalitarian government usually resets the clock to year zero. Hugo Chavez, when he took over Venezuela, declared that it was year zero. That is, it's the beginning of time. Nothing that's happened before matters. Okay? Now is the only beginning. There's no history. We're going to forget everything that came before and live in this totally new reality. We're not like that. We're never like that. We live in light of 2,000 years of church history, of 2,000 years of faithful people carrying this gospel to places near and far, to every tongue and tribe and nation. So we have much to be thankful for, and that should engender some humility in us. It should teach me that I'm a pretty small part of a very, very large story. And my part matters, but my part is not actually the central role as much as I would like to think that it is. Right? I mean, it's pretty easy for me to think that my life is the most important life that has ever been lived in all of history, right? I am the central character of everything. You know, when you're 4 years old, that is totally true, right? Okay. All the drama that's in your life is the biggest drama that has ever occurred anywhere, right? Okay. But by the time you're grown up some, you should start to realize that my part is actually fairly small, but it still matters. And that should give us some humility. So, and history is a means of, you know, it helps us do some synthesis. That is, you know, when we look at the past, it should help us to understand something about the future. And that connection happens through the present, through the now. And if we don't have any past, it's harder for us to understand anything about the future. It's also really important for us to keep in mind that, you know, all the stuff that's consuming us in this moment, this too shall pass. I tell my wife that from time to time, and she's like, shut up. Anyway, no, she doesn't say that. She would never say that. Anyway, but I mean, she's thinking that a little bit. Anyway, but this too shall pass. You know, we tend to make the challenges of the moment big and think, you know, how will we ever get through this? This too shall pass. The trials of the moment have been encountered in some form before, and this moment is part of a larger plan. So history, looking back, helps us to understand that and thereby persist in the face of difficulty, grow in the faith, deepen our foundations, and broaden our perspective. Different people in different places around the world have had to face different things down through the ages, and we can learn from that. And that should teach us it's not just about us. As much as I want it to be about me, it's not. So let's talk about what are some approaches to church history? So this is from some stuff that I'm using from Cairns's book, Christianity Through the Centuries. I pulled this, by the way, from the church library there because there's a couple, three copies of it in there. So I figured I could borrow one for a while and it would be okay. So this is a straight up text, if you will, about the history of the church across two millennia. And Cairns has a not particularly useful diagram in here on page 17 about these three ideas. So let's skip past this and talk about what does this really mean. So, God, man, what do we think about how man understands God? What do we think about how man knows God? What do we think about how man engages God? Well, first big idea is that God speaks to man, that God provides divine revelation, that God reaches down to man, providing revelation that allows man to know and understand God. Prophets, teachers, scripture, that all these things are ways that God speaks to man, and that man is spoken to by God. So this is the Hebraic tradition. This is what we got from the Jews, that God speaks and man listens. And Moses goes up to Mount Sinai and God speaks to him. Moses doesn't go up to Mount Sinai and say, hey, God, here's what I think is going on, and God doesn't say, oh, thanks, Moses, that's very helpful. No. Moses goes up to Mount Sinai, and God speaks. Okay? The prophets speak. Okay? Preachers and teachers speak. So that this is the fundamental idea. Well, that's one idea. Well, here's another idea. Another idea is that man pursues God, and man does so primarily through reason. That man uses the ability to reason and think and see evidence and to pursue ideas as a way to discover God. This is basically the Greek tradition. Plato, Aristotle, Philosophy is the tool by which you find the truth. You pursue truth by thinking big, thinking deeply, and this allows you to illuminate and understand God. But there's another possibility here. There's another thing, and that is, what about synthesis? That is, man is pursuing God by reason, and God is speaking some revelation, and it's the ability to put those two things together that creates understanding. So these are three different ways of understanding what is going on and understanding how does man know God and how can we understand anything. So, which tool? Which approach? Who does what? Who are we? We are Revelation people. Okay? We are the Reformed perspective is founded in the idea that the Hebraic idea that God speaks and we listen. Okay? That the word is authoritative. Okay? This is Paul, this is Augustine. That this revelation informs our reason, but that our reason is useless without the revelation. And so we believe that people don't understand the truth unless God reveals it to them. So that evangelism is not just your powerful ability to explain the truth. It's your faithfulness to carry this truth and God's work of revealing it to other people. Okay? Which means that you need to be faithful to explain this truth, to carry this truth, but it is God who makes it real to people, and people come to the faith because God speaks into their lives, because God reveals it to them. So that's the you know the tradition that we live in. The Word is unchanging, God is sovereign, the Word is an eternal standard that doesn't change through times and places. But that we respond to it in different ways, in different times and places, because we are different. But God is not. Man changes, but God does not. God's revelation is the same. So that's us. So, what about the reason, guys? It's a Greek tradition. It's philosophy drives that. Today, that's functionally the liberal tradition. That is, that's the tradition that says, look, the church needs to adapt to its context. It needs to interpret the word in light of the perceived reality all around. And it needs to find ways to flex and adapt to that because man discovers God and man from wherever we stand, we figure out what God is like and we apply that. And it's up to reason to drive that. That's the liberal church, if you will. Liberalism in the church, which I'm not talking about politics here. I'm talking about the idea of churches that believe that you adapt to the context, you change as you go, and that you see the word in light of your reason and in light of the context of the day. And so when you operate in this mode as a church, you say, hey, there's a bunch of stuff in the Bible that doesn't really apply anymore. There's a bunch of stuff in the Bible that it doesn't really mean that. There's a bunch of stuff in the Bible that's in that culture, and we don't do that anymore. So this is my reason takes me in the direction of Thomas Jefferson, where I'm editing the Bible because a bunch of it is, I'm smart enough to understand that that's not actually what God meant. God clearly meant something else. So, and I've got that. Okay. So this is, you know, reason is the path to edited Bible. I edit the Bible in ways that work for me. I get rid of the stuff that is uncomfortable for me. All the things that make me do stuff that makes me uncomfortable, I just say, well, you know, God didn't really mean that stuff. that doesn't apply today. Okay? And when you find yourself doing that, you know, that's uncomfortable. I don't think that applies to me. That's the path of reason. And that's the path that, builds the liberal church today. You know, that implies that human reason has primacy and that man finds God, that nature tells you things about God, but that it's fundamentally philosophical. So what about the synthesis thing? Basically, that's Roman Catholicism. Okay. Roman Catholicism is the fundamental place that says, look, we need to integrate these two approaches. We need to seek some balance. And probably the earliest figure in synthesis is Justin Martyr. So that's, you know, way back very early. Origen, Clement of Alexandria is a guy who starts down this road. Those are guys who, in the early ages of the church, said, you know what, you know, this divine revelation, this Jewish thing, that's a little too much. We need to balance that. And so, you know, in the Middle Ages, we see this in the Thomas Aquinas, and you know, the church baptizes Plato, we say, and finds a way to take Plato and take that philosophical tradition and bend it into the church in some useful way. We are not those guys. We're the revelation guys. So so that's our perspective. So so you know, we believe that, you know, reality in the church must be understood in light of the world. The liberal perspective, and this characterizes much of the church today, believe that the word and the church must be seen in light of the reality that you perceive. And they must be interpreted in light of that reality. And the Roman Catholic perspective is that the church is a keeper and interpreter of tradition, which is a synthesis of God's revelation and the products of man's reason. So how then should we think about this? Well, when we think about church history, we think about it from a Reformed perspective, that the reality that we see in the church that we have must be understood in light of the Word of God, that revelation. So, let's think about some elements of the history of the church. What are some things that are involved? I like this because, well, alliteration is fun. So, first one. The history of the church is about the propagation of the faith. How has the faith grown? Evangelism, missions, the conversion of people to every tongue and tribe and nation. That is a fundamental element of the history of the church. History of the church is also about politics. That is, how is the church related to the state? How is the church adapted to the political forces around it? What has the church's relationship been with the Roman Empire and with the Holy Roman Empire and with the Byzantine Empire and with the United States of America and any other place? There is always a political component because there is always some kind of state that the church has had to live in and deal with. And, of course, we have, you know, centuries in which the Pope functioned, in Rome, functioned as both a religious leader and a secular leader of a local state and had an army and, you know, was the Prince of Rome as his second job or sometimes really his first job. But the history of the church is partly the history of the church bumping up against the institutions of the state. And what does that look like? Thirdly, the history of the church is about persecution. The faith has been persecuted basically since the beginning. There's been opposition basically since the beginning. And the history of persecutions is the history of the expansion of the church. And it's the history of the people of God being faithful to this calling. So church polity is how the church operates. How is the church governed? How is it led? How does it worship? What's its ecclesiology and its liturgy? Those things are part of the polity of the church. This is the sort of stuff that most of us don't think about very much, except when the church is doing something that you don't want it to do, or not doing something that you do want it to do, at which point you start bumping up against this. But what kind of government does your church have? What kind of government does the church have? What governing structure does the church have on a larger basis, across political boundaries? But how does the church operate? The functional part, the trellis that supports the vine. And there's a whole bunch of that. Then there's this. Polemics. Polemics is, how do you speak truth? How do you oppose heresy? How do you codify the truth? What are the creeds that you write, the councils that you hold, the confessions that you commit yourself to? What is the theology that is foundational, that defines what you believe? And so when we think about the polemics, we think about the history of what have we believed and what are the ways that we've had to argue through and work out what do we believe. So praxis, the practice, how do we live out this faith? How shall we then live? How shall we influence the world? What does it look like to be us? What do we do because of this truth? And how do we do it? What liturgy, what music, what kind of public prayer? What do we actually do functionally? What kind of ministry do we engage in? These are praxis. These are the actual practices, the things that we are doing to actually execute what it means to be the church. And then lastly, of these, what do we teach? How do we teach it? How do we make disciples? How do we catechize people? How do we help people to be built up in the faith? What do we do? What kind of hymns do we sing? What kind of art do we post? What kind of architecture do we have? You know, I'm always saying, hey, we're Baptists. How do you know? You walk in this room, you should be able to decode that we're Baptists. There's a tank in the back, and the pulpit is in the middle. You walk in many other churches, that's not true. The tank in the back and the pulpit in the middle say something. They present to people what we believe. We believe that baptism is important. It's public, and it involves an ability to speak the truth, to share the truth. And we believe that the ministry of the word is fundamental, that it's core, that it's the most important thing that we do. So the pulpit's in the middle. You've been in churches where the pulpit's not in the middle, right? And that symbolizes that something else, that presentation says something else is more important. And so these, you know, like I said, I'm a sucker for alliteration. So, but these are elements of thinking about what are all the different elements of understanding the church down through the ages. So I wanted to throw those out at you. So let's think about some background. When you think about the church happens in a time, in a place, to people who have a history. It's not year zero. They're not blank sheets of paper. They come in with something. They have a cultural background, a history. There's a social way of doing things for those people. The people in the New Testament are in a culture that sees the world in a particular way. They have a history that informs the way that they think. Okay, so socio-cultural and historical factors are always a big part of the story. And so these are things that I really am personally very interested in. But I want to talk about these things. Starting Old Testament heritage. We have in the church a heritage that comes from the Old Testament. Okay? Jet tour through the Old Testament. The story starts with patriarchs. What does it mean? What is the era of the patriarchs? What does that mean? Well, in the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and down in Joseph and in that era, in that age, the church was basically a family. The family is a basic unit of life. It's a basic unit in the church. The beginning of the church goes back to 12 tribes, which are the product of a family. Families are fundamental to the Old Testament story, and they're fundamental to the way that we think about the church still today. And much of the Old Testament is about family problems, family conflict, issues about inheritance and brothers who either get along or who don't get along, and who marries who and when and under what circumstances. All things that are actually still part of what we grapple with today in the church. So part of our Old Testament heritage is family, because family is fundamental to the Old Testament story. It's still fundamental to us. After the family, the 12 tribes part of the story, you have the era of the judges. Okay, I'm being like super high, you know, 60,000 foot view here, right? But what's true about the era of the judges? In the era of the judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And how'd that go? Just in a few words. Okay? Yeah. So not well, right? Okay. And one of the things that you see when you read the book of Judges, by the way, is that it gets even worse the longer it goes on. Okay? The successive judges are, the first judges are fairly effective and it kind of works, but the longer that it goes on, the less effective the judges are and the less it works, right? So in the era where everyone does what is right in their own eyes, there is, you know, when there's very limited authority, there's no accountability, there is limited effectiveness, people are unwilling to lead. You know, the story of Deborah in the book of Judges is about, there aren't any men who are willing to man up and lead and be responsible. And so Deborah finally said, fine, God's calling me, and I'll do it, because every man that I know has failed. Okay? Something that echoes today, right? In the lives of a lot of single moms and other people. Okay? So, but Judges tells us when there's a failure to lead, when there's no accountability, that bad stuff happens. Maybe not immediately, but it will. And the echoes down through the generations are incredibly painful and difficult. So, kingdoms. The people cried out for a king. God raised up a king, then replaced him with a king that was a man after God's own heart. And we see an era of kingdoms. And, of course, as soon as Solomon is dead, the kingdom ends up split. And the split kingdoms are brothers, as you will, which means that they spend most of their time fighting with each other. And only occasionally, you know, sometimes a bigger somebody, they fight together when a bigger somebody comes to threaten them. But other than that, they mostly fight each other because, you know, brothers. But the kingdoms fail because the idea that the king will save us proves to not be true. The people want political leaders so they can look like everybody else because political leaders will save us. But it's not true. Somebody you've talked to recently or read their stuff on Facebook has told you that political leaders will save us. They haven't been reading their Old Testament. Okay? Wasn't true then. It's not true now. Okay? Another thing that shows up in the Old Testament is exile. What are some exiles that happen in the Old Testament? Abram is sent out of Ur. He is exiled to a faraway place, a land that I will show you by God. This is totally counterintuitive and countercultural. Okay, Ur is the biggest city of the day. It's New York City. Everything is happening there. All the great shows are playing there. It's the big stuff, right? It's the big time. And Abraham is called to leave that and go to Kansas or someplace, okay? And when you read that, you should be thinking, whoa, wait a minute. What is Abraham thinking? You know, go out into the furthest reaches, the tule weeds where nobody is. What are you thinking, God? Joseph is sent in slavery to Egypt. Eventually his brothers come because of a famine. The people are exiled to Egypt, where they are subsequently enslaved. Moses leads them out of Egypt triumphantly and into 40 years of exile in the wilderness. Eventually, the kingdom is split, and the Assyrians come and exile the people of Israel, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, send them into faraway exile, from which most of them never return. Then the Babylonians come and conquer Judah and send the people into exile in Babylon, an exile from which many of them, perhaps most of them, eventually return. Later, post-New Testament, the Romans come and destroy Jerusalem and exile the Jews from Jerusalem for several centuries. Several centuries, Jews are banned from being in sight of the city of Jerusalem. The cycle of exile is a key part of our Old Testament heritage, and it's supposed to teach us something. You are sojourners on this earth. Not from here. You're only visiting. And you should live like that. That's part of our Old Testament heritage. That's part of what we're supposed to learn. Foreign occupation. Almost as soon as they move into the promised land, the Philistines occupy part of the territory and subjugate them. The story of the book of Judges is the story of there's an occupation from Edom, and there's an occupation from the Philistines, and another occupation from the Philistines, eventually Moab. The kingdoms become dependent on Egypt for military support and become an Egyptian satellite for a century or more. The Egyptians eventually fail. The Assyrians occupy the northern part of the land for a century or more. The Babylonians and subsequently the Persians occupy the whole land for 70 years. Eventually, a guy named Alexander the Great comes through with an army of Greeks and expels the Persians and occupies the land. And his successors occupy the land for 200 and some odd years until the Maccabean Revolt. And after a brief period of independence, the Roman army comes and occupies the land. So in the New Testament era, when the church is founded, the land is under occupation, and it's part of a long cycle of occupations. What are the occupations about? Why does that keep happening? Taxes. Okay. It's always about taxes. These are reminders that we're dependent on God. These are reminders that when we fail to depend on God, that we'll be vulnerable to other kinds of things. These are reminders that it's really not about political power, being great in our own minds and in this era. But the cycle of foreign occupation is large in the way that people in the New Testament era think. And then there's prophets. telling the future, and telling the truth, and telling the future. And most of prophecy is foretelling. It's telling the truth, not so much telling the future. So, but prophets calling people back to the ages, and people in the Old Testament, you know, their record of listening to prophets and doing the right thing is not good. Not good. Not good would be correct. Okay, Jeremiah, is the second longest of the prophetic books in the Old Testament, and Jeremiah's ministry is noteworthy for what? It's absolute and total failure. How many converts did Jeremiah make successfully? None. How many people believed Jeremiah and did what was right for any period of time? None. So there are voices speaking and people not listening. This should sound familiar. Okay? But the truth endures through the ages. And it's important to keep in mind, you know, our Old Testament heritage. The Old Testament is all these stories about people. And most of these people, you know, all these people are sinners. And most of these people do the wrong thing. You know, we're not supposed to look at the Old Testament and think, oh, I do like that. There's a this thing running around on the internet about, you know, here's an Old Testament way to find a wife. And it's all the stupid, bad, evil ways that people found wives down through the Old Testament. It's like, no, those aren't in there to endorse those ideas, okay? Those aren't in there to validate those, to justify, you know, kidnapping the dancers at the Harvest Festival and carrying them off as a wife. No, that's not. It's in there to document the sins of God's people. We are heirs to a scripture that documents the sins of the people who came before us. That should impact the way that we think about ourselves and about the church and about our lives together. So so let's talk a little bit about the Old Testament here, the issues of worship and practice. In the Old Testament, you see a worship, which is first focused on the temple and or on the tabernacle and then on the temple. But worship is defined, the polity and practice of the church is defined around the temple worship. There, and in temple worship, there are priests who administer and who do the worship, who run the sacrifices. There are rabbis who teach the word, who teach the truth, who teach the law. There are scribes whose job it is to preserve the law, to make copies of it, to hand it down, to ensure that it is correct, and to stipulate what the law is and to help people understand how to apply the law in their lives. That's the temple system. It's based around the focus on the law. It's based around the idea that sacrifice is required, that blood must cover sin, that there is some ongoing need to remind us of sin and our need to be cleansed of it. And there are a cycle of festivals where people are called to remember and in many cases to rejoice. The Passover, the Feast of Booths, the Purim. Remember these things. Purim, of course, remembering the events of the book of Esther, where Pur was cast to find when the people would be destroyed. And the God turned that around. And so people were called on an annual basis to remember that and to rejoice, to give thanks, to look backwards. The Passover, look backwards. Understand that God passed over his people when he was bringing great condemnation on Egypt and used that to lead them out of the land. And so in the intertestamental period, you know, in the days before the New Testament, you have all kinds of different Jews, which are different groups that are trying to figure out how does this work? What does all this mean? What should we do with this? Is the law rules that we must live by, or is it guidelines? You know, the Pirate's Code. Okay, kind of make it, figure out, okay? How serious should you be about the law? The Pharisees say very serious about the law. The law is ultimately serious. You should memorize every single item of it. You should be rigorous about your application of that and your understanding of that. The Essenes say you should be very serious about the law, and it should cause you to live apart from people who do not live by the law. The Zealots say you should care enough about the law to be willing to kill somebody over it. Sadducees say, you know, that's a little over the top. You know, let's find a way to kind of use the law, but to see it more sort of conceptually. So, shall we engage the culture or separate from it? Still a question, right? Okay, the Sadducees say, no, you got to really engage the culture. In fact, you can't be separated. You really have to be very connected to the culture that's around you if you're going to have any influence. And otherwise, you know, they might come down, tear down the temple or some catastrophe like that. So clearly we have to engage the culture. The Essenes say, you got to separate from the culture and go live somewhere else, maybe in the desert by yourselves, to be away from those influences. The Pharisees say you just have to live really different. You got to dress different. You got to look different. You got to talk different. You got to walk different. You got to be different in identifiable ways every single way. And the Zealots say, you know what you ought to do to the culture? You ought to overturn it. You ought to destroy it. You got to blow it up. The people who don't get it, you got to fight. Okay? So there is an urge to purification here. The Pharisees think you're purified because you follow the law in rigorous ways and you purify yourself on the inside. Jesus eventually says, what about them? You are whitewashed tombs. You are rotten on the inside. You don't get it. You missed the mark. Okay, but attention and adherence to the law is the big driver for the Pharisees. For the Essenes, it's just you get purified by getting away from things that are impurity. You go live in your own community. You stay away. You don't have any friends who are unbelievers. You don't deal with people who are unbelievers. You stay away from unbelievers. You have your own television network. You have your own radio station. Okay. Well, sort of. Anyway, so, and the Zealots believe that you purify the land by driving out the impure. The most committed of the Zealots were Sicarii. Sicarii is a word that means a long, sharp knife. And Sicarii carried long, sharp knives. And in Jerusalem, in the crowded streets, when they saw somebody, they thought, that person doesn't get it. That person totally has failed us, they stabbed him in the crowd and walked away. That kind of murder in the crowd, being stabbed by somebody with a long, sharp knife when you didn't even know they were next to you, happened fairly routinely at the time of the New Testament. Because the Zealots said we have to purify the land by killing people who don't understand. So, at the time that Jesus walked the earth, there were very few high priests who died of natural causes. So, let's talk about... I'm over time. Give me one more slide here. So next time, I'm going to talk about foundations for us, the Jewish perspective that infuses a lot of what we do, which is driven, first of all, by messianic prophecy and the things that the Jews thought might be true about the Messiah. It's driven by the Jews' invention of time. And I'm not kidding about that. The Jews invented time. If you have a watch, It's the fault of the Jews. Okay? It boils down to that. Okay? If you used a different calendar this year than the one that you'd used last year, that's the fault of the Jews. Nobody else had thought of that before they did. So we'll talk about time next time, and we'll talk about the Jewish perspective of God, the Messiah, the apocalypse. But these are the foundations that we get from Judaism. And then we'll take a look next time at foundations that we get from the Greek perspective and the Roman perspective. And what is, at the founding of the church, the cultural forces and the things that influence those 12 guys that Jesus called as disciples, the other people that became apostles, and those who were drawn into the church. The people that you see in the book of Acts are all people who are culturally Jewish, Greek, Roman. And most of them are not just one of those things. There's some mixture of those things. And the way that they respond to Jesus is driven by that thinking.